In Tucson, Arizona, a man discovers that his plain old Navajo blanket qualifies as a national treasure. A woman discovers that the card table she bought at a yard sale for $25 is actually worth six figures. These are true stories, and they all happened on Antiques Roadshow, Public Broadcasting's hit series. If you've seen the show, then you're probably familiar with Lee and Leslie Kino, identical twin brothers and antiques appraisers. The Kino brothers began hunting for treasures as kids and just never stopped. Leslie remembers that around age 10, he and his brother started exploring the back roads near their home in upstate New York, looking for the iron hinges from old barn doors.
The area we grew up in was very rich in history, and you could literally drive down back roads and find, you know, fallen down barns, and the hinges would be there lying in the brambles there, you know, in the field. And we just loved the shapes, the rat tail hinges, the bean handles, we call them, with a sort of a lima bean shape in the top. The fact that these were made by blacksmiths sometimes, you know, up to 200 years ago, it's amazing. These are just lying here in the field. So it was a great opportunity. We also got involved with early bottles and glass flasks that we would find in these homestead sites, you know, in the refuse pits.
The bottle dumps, right.
Now, I'm curious to know whether you were buying them because they looked pretty to you, or because you knew that they were going to be valuable, or
I think it was this early urge to collect. Really, I mean, the bottle digging and the hunting for hinges was really this. I think it's a primal urge, I think, to collect things, whether it's seashells or insects. When you're a kid, we actually collected bumblebees, dried bumblebees once, and lined them up and kind of graded them from the smallest to the biggest. But we would bring the hinges home and really compare them. The good, better, best, basically. And value was certainly important, and that was a lot of incentive, but it wasn't the primary reason, I think, that we were out there looking for things. Exactly. We would pull books out when we found something. Later on, we got into early English pottery and pewter, all kinds of other things, and then finally to furniture. But we actually started a library of research books, and while a lot of our friends were there reading Mad Magazine late into the midnight hour, we usually had a copy of Furniture Treasury on her lap, and we would play a game, but every even page, I would get everything on the page, and Lee would get every odd page,
right.
And we'd go through, you know, 1,500 right. pages like that. And then we'd read Mad Magazine, right? And then we'd read Mad, yeah.
I guess I'm sort of relieved about that. Now, when did you begin to sell? Because I can imagine people, even at a flea market, saying, you know, I can take this pair of kids here for a ride on those things.
Well, I think sometimes we thought we were taking them for a ride, because we'd get them, if we bought something really reasonably, if it was something priced at what we call a sleeper price. Yeah, we didn't hold on to that many things then when we were really young. And a successful sale is the best indicator of that someone else believes in your taste in objects. So we loved to turn things over, and we kept track in detail of everything. I think we got away with murder sometimes, because I remember a couple times a piece was marked like, let's say, $20 for an early picture, and because I remember the lady saying, "Aren't they such nice little cute kids? Look at that! Aren't they sweet? Let's make it $8 to them." You know, so we'd get. We don't get away with that anymore, unfortunately.
No, it's kind of too bad. Now, there was a friend of your parents, I gather, that you actually made your first purchase from?
Yes, Myrtle Dicker was a retired school teacher in Coldbrook, New York. And when we were very young, our parents would bring us there to her home, which was filled with treasures. Under every bed, in every cupboard, I mean, under every table was a little gem, or in every drawer was basically a treasure. From 17th century Delftware to great Tiger Maple kettle stands. And we would spend long hours there when we were growing up. Sometimes our parents would actually go in the car and nap while we finished our negotiations with Myrtle. But the amazing thing is, nothing ever in that house ever had a price tag. She was an antique dealer, but the sign had long since fallen down in front. And it was an amazing experience. The phone never rang when we were there. No one came to call. We were there in our own world with Myrtle, basically. It was great practice, actually, for what Leslie and I do today, actually negotiating sales and trying to. It was tough to get something out of that house. You had to really use every ounce of persuasion that you had, because Myrtle loved what she had.
She loved it.
She didn't want to let it go. Even though she was a dealer, right? But exactly.
Well, let's talk about some of the hidden treasures that you've found over the years. It's what you call your book. You have looked all over the place for these, and by now found a lot of them. Where do you go these days to look for what you call hidden treasures?
Well, hidden treasures, as we know from the Antiques Roadshow, can turn up in the most unlikely places in the world. And some of the adventures that Lee and I have chronicled in this book take us all over the globe. One piece that I was privileged to have handled and was actually a secretary bookcase that turned up in a very small apartment in Paris, on the right bank of Paris. It was made by Christopher Townsend, the great master craftsman in Newport in the 1740s in Rhode Island, and it made its way over to France, descended through the relatives of the Appleton family for whom it was made in Boston. He was the man that ordered it. And the piece came up at Sotheby's and ended up bringing $8,250,000, which was the highest price, is still the highest price a piece of furniture sold for in Sotheby's 255-year history.
There's another one that follows that. You, I don't remember which one of you it was, found a pair of chairs, and the backs weren't there, but you went to look at them. You had to puzzle them together?
Yes, they were found in a chicken coop, actually. Some boys were using them in the top of a chicken coop. They had kind of a no-girls-allowed, boys-only club, and these chairs were just strewn across the top of this chicken coop. And I actually had to rubber band the pieces together, and there was one piece missing. And that piece, the man said he just couldn't find it, and so I gave him a check for the chairs, all rubber banded together. And even though this piece of the style of the back was missing, I asked him one more time and said, "Are you sure you don't have it?" And he said, "No, I don't have those pieces." So I said, "If you find those pieces, I'll give you $4,000. And all of a sudden he said, "Honey, get that box out of the garage." So the wife comes out of the garage with a box of junky things. I reach inside and it had the two pieces that were missing. He looked at me as if to say, "Well, are you going to give me that check for $4,000? And of course, I wrote my second check as a dealer for $4,000.
Most expensive broken piece of wood in the world, probably.
I think it set a new record.
But the chairs ended up being worth...
The chairs we later sold in the six figures, and to Eddie Nicholson, a well-known collector then.
Wow. Another thing that I'm curious about, and I don't think you talked about it in the book, although I may have missed it, it's clear that both of you appreciate the craftsmanship that went into creating these things. Have you ever looked at modern creations with the same kind of appreciation?
Well, certainly. I think that some of the handmade furniture made by great, really master craftsmen that's being produced today are incredible. Some of those furniture items, there are a group of cabinet makers in New Hampshire and Vermont that make incredible furniture.
Absolutely.
And I think some of those creations will eventually be really treasured heirlooms.
Yeah, I think George Nakashima's work is just gorgeous, and the quality of the wood and the craftsmanship.
Oh, I love those pieces.
20th century craftsmen. What those pieces don't have is for example, compared to 18th century Queen Anne furniture, as we have to remember, these pieces were made during a period of time in America when the democracy was being formed. It was one of the greatest democracies in the world. So the history and the hardships that these craftsmen went through, the lack of materials, the working by candlelight, the threat of attack by various people, especially before the revolution around, you know, all that comes into play when you look at a piece of 18th century furniture.
Are there still deals out there to be found, or are people becoming so wise to this now that they will not sell pieces for $25 at a yard sale anymore?
Well, I think the great thing about the Antiques Roadshow and also the internet is that people are becoming more educated, and an educated buyer and an educated seller are both good things. And I think it's wonderful that people out there are being more aware of what they have. And
exactly, there's more information out there, which is great.
Terrific. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Lee and Leslie Kino are antiques appraisers. They've worked for Christie's and Sotheby's in New York. They appear frequently on the PBS program Antiques Roadshow. They've also written a book called Hidden Treasures, Searching for Masterpieces of American Furniture.